just another day. It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day. Just another day. It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day on earth. It's just another day on earth. One day.
What other better way to start the Ink Studs Hour than a little Brian Eno to ease you in? That was Just Another Day off the album Just Another Day on Earth. Lovely track. This is Ink Studs, the radio show where we talk about comics. And if you've been listening to CITR, you may have noticed that we are doing a funding drive currently because CITR is a non-profit radio station. And basically, we have money goes towards making stuff better here and being able to keep the station going good, because Ink Studs is a pretty unique show, and I don't think you'll hear it on CBC, especially the amount of times I cuss.
well.
So what we've done, I'm sure you've heard other people talking about pitching pledges for the funding drive. We at the Ink Studs had a kind donation from Raincoast Books of products from Drawn and Quarterly and Top Shelf Books. So I'm going to run over the list of them and then give you the phone numbers to call. Popeye Volume 1 by E.C. Seeger. Peanuts Volume 1. Shortcomings by Adrian Tomine. Isn't even out in comic stores yet.
Yay!
Bagel's Lucky Hat by Hector Mumbly, a.k.a. Dave Cooper. Dave Cooper's children's book. How awesome is that? Exit Wounds by Rutu Modan. I probably totally mispronounced her name. Lovely book about Israel and stuff. It's gorgeous. You gotta look at it, Colin. Mm. Spent by Joe Matt. Another wonderful cartooning masterpiece. Anders Nilsson's Dogs and Water. Anders Nilsson is one of my favorite cartoonists right now, and I think you all need to read his stuff. Southern Cross by Lawrence Hyde, that's published by Drawn and Quarterly. I haven't actually had a chance to look at it. It looks really neat, really good sparse block print style. James Sturm's America, which collects The Gollum's Mighty Swing, The Revival, and the one about
100 feet.
Below. Yeah, all excellent stuff. And last but not least, King Cat Classics by John Porcellino. They're all excellent books. If you want to pledge money, call 604-822-8648. That is 604-822-8648. And another number is 822-1242, 604-822-1242. Just make sure you mention that it's Ink Studs. It's the reason. Well, you know, CITR is the reason, but Ink Studs is the show, so you can find out about those books. The pledge amounts are $25, which you get a friend's card from CITR, to $45, two friend's card, and one CD from CITR, and that's where you start getting the books. so you get one of our books, because they're all pretty pricey books, so $25 it's $45. For most of the books, except for the Popeye and James Sturm America and King Cat Classics, you can get two of those for $60 or just one of them for $45 as well. If you're doing $101.9, get it, 101.9 FM, we'll get you a bunch of stuff. And same with $150 amount or $250 plus, we'll work out a nice package. The comics are first come, first serve, so get them while they're hot. And now, let's start talking to our guest, Nick Abadzis. I'm sorry, Nick. My horrible mispronouncing. There are interviews where I pronounce someone's name wrong most of the time. So I apologize now, and if I do it again, I apologize again.
No, it's just it's one of those crazy Greek names that's got an A and a Z in it. So it gets confusing.
And I'm studying ancient Greece right now, so I should get it. Yeah, the classical studies course at one of the local colleges. Focusing on all the different aspects like literature, art history, history, and all sorts of fun stuff. And it's a good course.
Cool.
Yeah, right now we're... I just read a big chunk of the Iliad.
Right. Wow, you really are rolling then.
Yeah. The next week I got to read the Bacchae.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, that's something I confess I never studied. My Greek kind of... goes as far as my roots and not into my education perhaps as far as it should, you know.
Well, the closest I got before this course was probably Eddie Campbell's Bacchus, so.
Ah, oh, man, that's real education.
They just drink all the time. So why don't I say why you've joined us today. Your book, Laika, a wonderful story about Laika, the dog that went to space.
Yeah.
And today of all days, we had this booked well in advance because you're currently doing a tour throughout the States promoting the book, and I just realized yesterday it's Sputnik Day.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 50 years of this space age.
Yeah,
right there
from the first Sputnik.
Yeah,
that was the very very first. That's Colin, right?
Yeah,
hello
Colin. it was the very very first artificial satellite that went up 50 years ago yesterday, and that was really the thing that totally changed the world.
The beeps that changed the world?
Well, the beeps that changed the world, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's hard for a lot of people to imagine now just what an impact the launching of the Sputnik had at that time.
Yeah, I think it is. And that's... When I was doing the book, I was really trying to sort of imagine myself into that headspace, you know, that world that... apart from kind of cars and trucks and telephones, hadn't really changed an awful lot in 100 years. You know, there was certain technological advancement, but suddenly your average Joe had to get his head around the idea of something above his head that was, you know, going round and round the world, and a lot of people just couldn't grasp it. And then, of course, there was this phenomenon where you had lots of people who had ham radios, and they were tuning into the kind of the beep, 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 beep that the Sputnik was sending back, which was proof positive that there was indeed this piece of Soviet hardware circling the Earth. So that freaks a lot of people out, as you might imagine. So,
if you don't mind me asking, how old are you to see if you're like of the age, or were you a young person when Sputnik? Like, I have no idea of your biographical information.
No, I'm a child of the 60s.
Okay, well then, never mind.
That's well before my time. I kind of got fascinated with space through the... I can very, very dimly remember the Apollo space program, the later ones. so around sort of 72, I think, when it all started being wrapped up. I can just about remember that, and I can remember things like the Apollo-Soyuz link-up. That was that really kind of... something about spaceflight always kind of grabbed my attention as a kid, so I just kind of became fascinated with it. And but, of course, the kind of all the U.S. stuff, which was fantastic, was right there. You could find out loads of information about it, whereas the Soviet stuff was just... it was mysterious. It was kind of enigmatic. You had... really, it was just sort of Yuri Gagarin and Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2 that was that information was readily available on, at least in the kind of kids' books that I was reading. So,
mm-hmm.
So I think that's why, that's certainly why Laika stuck in my head and Gagarin. They you know, they were sort of this, the faces of this faceless, strange, grey country over to the east, whereas, you know, the American stuff was all there for everyone to see, and it was very cool, and you could watch launches and everything on TV.
Is that part of the reason for going in doing the book? Is just that chance to really, like, go in and research it?
I think when I took it on, I had no idea of the scope of the subject matter. I just thought it might be a good story, and I envisaged doing something fairly short and fairly, you know, straightforward documentary in nature. I didn't really think, okay, I'm going to, you know, this is going to become some sort of epic Russian story that you know, takes in all these kind of other characters besides the dog. I was just thinking, I'll do just something, you know, it'll be maybe at most 20-25 pages long. Kind of like publish it as a sort of cool pamphlet, and you know, that was my original idea. And then
I just want to let people know it's 200 pages.
Yeah.
Well, you've gone beyond just about any cartoonist I know in doing their research. You actually traveled to Russia to research this book. Did you learn some Russian?
I didn't, no. I mean, I'm sort of vaguely familiar with the Cyrillic alphabet because it's the same one the Greeks use, but I don't know any Russian as such. I mean, it kind of came down to the fact that, like, I'd done X amount of research, and I'd basically finished the second draft of the book, and I just thought, this is ridiculous. I've got all these things that I want to say, and I need to go there. I need to go to Moscow. To kind of get a sense of both the geography of the place and the people who live there, and I'd written to a bunch of institutions there, none of whom got back to me very readily, but I was sort of hoping I might go out there and maybe interview the last surviving members of the Cosmodog program, something like that. In the end I didn't manage to get in contact with any of those people, but I did have a contact at the Museum of Cosmonautics who was she basically didn't reply to my letter. And then I turned up at her desk at the Museum of Cosmonautics a couple of months later. Said, "Hi, it's me." And she was like, "Oh, I remember you. Okay." And I sort of figured out while I was there as well, this is just the way Russians work. They're just glacially slow about it.
It's that inherent bureaucracy they've had for many decades.
They didn't think you were a spy or anything.
No, I really don't think they knew how to take me. I don't think they knew what they were. Russia, as far as I know, I think there are a few underground cartoonists, but they don't have a comics industry to speak of, let alone any kind of awareness of the wider art form. So it was a funny experience. I just think that because they were sort of like, "What are you doing?" In the end, I said, "Look, I'm writing a book. It's got lots of illustrations that I'm drawing about, you know, the Soviet space program." So that was okay. They understood that. And the lady there got me an invitation to Korolev's house, and Korolev being the chief designer of rockets of the Soviet space program. And that was sort of important because suddenly it was real. And, I turned up there on my first day in Moscow, and I was looking around his house. And this was a guy who I'd researched pretty thoroughly through books and through talking to a couple of space historians. And it was like, okay, right, he really did exist. He's not just a character in a book. It became it just fleshed it all out in my mind for me, and I could sort of inhabit the character a little more, you know, in the sense of understand that he was this hero to the Russian people, but they didn't even know while he was alive, none of them even knew that he existed. That was the sort of secrecy that he had to work under. So yeah, that was an eye opener.
He's quite the fascinating person too. Just even your brief touch on his biological, or his not biological, his
biography.
I'm tired.
Biographical.
There we go. His person, not his personage.
Yeah.
His roots in like his time in the Gulag, in a Gulag, and stuff. How is that researching that kind of stuff like? And tell people about this fascinating guy.
I really felt that he was sort of one of these lost figures of the 20th century. Once I kind of understood what he'd been through, it kind of opened up. It opened up a central theme of the book, because in a sense, yes, it's a book about a dog, a sort of a cosmo dog, but it's sort of also about cycles of abuse and about how systems and people can perpetrate those. If we don't recognize them, if we don't break out of them, then we're doomed to repeat those cycles. So that's sort of one of the themes that I had, I think, subconsciously. I don't think I was very conscious about that at the beginning. As I say, the whole project grew enormously. So when I started out, I just thought, it'll be a cool thing to do because it'll satiate my need to tell a story about Russian space history, and it will, you know, maybe I'll get, it'll give me something a little bit more than that, and it did. And Korolev was really the key to that. Finding out that he'd been through such physical and mental hardship in his life, and the fact that he kind of then went on to basically, you know, through sheer willpower and political maneuvering, mm-hmm. and very, very smart maneuvering, he got the Russian space program up and running with the support of just a few other people, who, you know, sort of other shadowy background figures who. You know, they weren't all about kind of building missiles. And, I mean, that was ostensibly the reason why he kind of built the R-7 rocket that lifted Laika into orbit, because that was really an ICBM. But really, if you sort of look past all that and read between the lines, he was, you know, very, you know, sort of romantic, sort of a dreamer, because he built this thing as a precursor to getting a Russian walking on the moon, which was really what he was all about. He was driven, and he drove other people, and getting a sense of his character was sort of weird, because I guess to an extent I kind of I got inspired by that myself, because it was like, oh right, you know, if he can drive himself this far, you know, what can the rest of us do? What can us mere cartoonists do? It's
like, mere, you know, cartoonists.
I think at that point that's when I realized it was expanding and pretty rapidly. So yeah, the first draft was 135 pages, and then I spoke to Mark Siegel, and he said, look, you know, what else do you need? I said, well, can we do it slightly longer? He said, if you need more pages, just go ahead. And he was incredibly generous and supportive in terms of how the story was growing and taking on its own characteristics, and that's why it ended up 200 pages, really.
I'm curious of how you got involved with First Second, because like my little bit of research of what I could gather from your previous work, you've got some anthology stuff, the Millennium Fever series from DC.
Yeah.
What other kind of stuff previous to that have you had, and like how did you get, you know, this... You know, big book published.
I'll give you a sort of quick career overview, I guess. I started out as I suppose the nearest equivalent to an alternative cartoonist in the very, very late 80s, early 90s in England. There was a magazine called Deadline, which was a sort of comics and music magazine.
That was edited by Jamie Hewlett, right?
Jamie Hewlett was one of the other cartoonists,
okay.
Involved in it, who created Tank Girl along with another guy, Alan Martin. And it was actually edited by Steve Dillon, who is latterly known as the artist on Preacher, which is written by Garth Ennis, I think.
known for a fair amount of cuss words.
Yep. Yes, indeed. But yeah, there was this scene happening, and then Hewlett was part of it, Garth was part of it, I was a part of it, Philip Bond was a part of it. A lot of people who've kind of gone on to either work at Vertigo or they've continued working. Mm-hmm. But it was this scene that it lasted until about 94, 95, and then basically the bottom fell out of the UK comic market, and all these cool little magazines just vanished overnight, and a lot of people were left high and dry with not really anywhere to go. So I had two characters actually in Deadline, Hugo Tate being the first and foremost, and that got partially collected in an edition which was published by Tundra, and I think that it got so badly distributed basically the company went under.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, if it's by Tundra, it's hard to find, most likely, then.
Right. So, yeah, so that's probably my kind of best-known prior work, prior to Leica, in sort of alternative comics. There's the later DC stuff, but I don't think there was anything I did that was particularly well-known over here, on this side of the Atlantic. After the bottom fell out of the UK comics market, I mean, it was really like, okay, what do I do now? And I did that one DC miniseries, mm-hmm. which was like 4 or 5 issues long with Duncan Segredo. But I was aware that it wasn't really the sort of direction I wanted to go in. Which was probably a crazy thing to think, but I was young and naive, so I hope you'll forgive me. But I sort of thought, okay, you know, I want to do sort of just kind of slightly more outlandish stuff. And I was approached at that time to do some children's graphic novels. And so I revived another of my old Deadline characters, who was this sort of tall ectoplasmic blob called Mr. Plebus. And I basically did this for kind of kids 8 to 12-year-old. I did 4 of those. And I got involved sorting out kind of content, similar sort of content for educational BBC websites, and I worked on a kids' literacy scheme. And around about 2000, I came over here because friends invited me to SPX, the Alternative Comics Expo in Washington, D.C., that's held every year.
In lovely Bethesda.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And that really sort of refired my enthusiasm. I was sort of thinking, well, I've sort of spent 5 years doing kind of kids' books, basically. It'd be nice to do some of my own work again that, that's a little more personal. And I guess I endeavored to... that sort of brings us up to about 2002. And from that was sort of where I had the first glimmerings of the idea of Leica. And I was contributing a few short stories to a few anthologies by that point, too. But it wasn't until about 2004 I really got stuck in. It's taken about 3 years, I guess. And I think that brings us up to date, yeah. So.
Up to Leica. So, and that kind of explains my question I had in my head about the change in styles, because I've got a couple of A1s here that you have stories in.
Oh, yeah.
The Atomica one and the Epic one. And the style is completely different. Like, it's not the same creator looking at those and looking at Leica.
Yeah. Which one is that? That's the boy who defied gravity, right?
Yeah, that's in the Atomica one.
Yeah, I remember doing that. No, I guess they're not. They're very different works. I think with both of those, I was really sort of at an experimental stage. I'd done a long run on Hugo Tate in Deadline. And I don't know if you're familiar with the character, but he was basically a stick man who was sort of lost in a figurative world. So he and as the strip progressed, he became more and more fleshed out, literally. And it was sort of rites of passage strip. I think I'd kind of done a long run on that, drawing things in a very scrawly way, and I was just experimenting with different styles, which is something I always do. I find it hard to kind of nail myself down to any kind of particular storytelling mode. If I do that, I find I want to remain fresh, you know, both to myself and to anybody reading my stuff. I want to keep surprising myself, because I feel if I do that, if I manage that, then hopefully that will communicate to a reader too.
Was that some kind of was that aspect kind of a challenge for doing something like Leica, where you have such a sheer volume of work within one piece, of like trying to maintain the cohesiveness?
Yeah, I think maybe that's part of it. I know I started it very determined to keep the entire thing together. Oh, hi guys. Sorry, I've got some company here. I'm just on the phone doing an interview. That's my friend's kids.
Hi, kids.
So we had. Where were we? We were talking about Leica.
About the usage of being able to maintain the style, even though you're saying you like to change it up.
Yeah. It was. I think I got bored with what I was doing. It was I'd done a lot of children's stuff, and they kind of always demanded this very cartoony. Sort of, you know, it's kind of fun, sort of big round shape sort of style, and I wanted to kind of get something a little grittier going. And I had this style that I was doing a lot in sketchbooks, which I never managed to kind of translate into my work, into my published work as easily. But something about this particular story kind of knocked a switch in my mind, and I started drawing larger. I was really, really determined to kind of get a focus and get something that was that actually nailed the thing that I had in my head, if that makes sense. I had a sort of image in my head of how I wanted it to look, and it wasn't this reliable old style that I'd had for, like, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9 years, which stood me in good stead. It was great. It was fine, but. I don't feel it was really me. So, and all this kind of sketchbook work that I was doing was much more. It was looser. It was much less refined. Closer to the source. And I think I just started to trust myself more. And that's where that kind of grainier look came from. Anyway, as for the writing, I think it was literally just a. I kind of became obsessed with the story, and I just had to get it out of me. So it was possibly some sort of obsessive compulsive cartoonist disease. I really don't know.
And I don't think you're alone in that. I think many cartoonists get into that zone. I'm gonna take a quick song break.
Sure.
Let yourself have a little breath. What song would you like to hear?
I think you already played the Brian Eno one, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go for the Kate Bush one.
Alrighty.
Oh, I like Kate Bush.
There we go. Colin's happy. Just remind people, this is CITR 101.9 FM, and we're talking to Nick Abzaz?
Abzaz.
You're going to kill me by the end of it.
I'm not even going to try.
And a reminder for people to listen or to call 822 8648 or 822-1242. That's 822-8648 or 822-1242 to donate for the funding drive. And this is Nocturne by Kate Bush. We'll be right back.
Into
ITR 101.9 FM. That was Miss Kate Bush off the album Ariel. The song is Nocturne. This is the ITR 101.9 FM, the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. Really, we don't talk about comics. We talk to comic creators. And we get to talk to some of the most diverse selection of creators out there, from Chester Brown to Joe Sacco to John Porcellino to Neil Adams and Tim Sale. Quite the range in creators. Reminder, people, that we're doing the funding drive right now. $25 gets you a friends card. $45 gets you two friends card. And one CD, the CITR friends card, gets you discounts at various stellar Vancouver shops. And $60, two friends cards, one CITR t-shirts, one CD. $101.9 gets you two friends cards, one CDs, one CD, two t-shirts. And as well, you donate $45 or more, and you get selections from this great selection of books from Raincoast Books, featuring publishers Top Shelf and Drawn and Quarterly, or not Top Shelf, Raincoast, Drawn and Quarterly, and Fantagraphics. I didn't get nothing from Top Shelf, but I guess I should have asked them. Popeye Volume 1 by E.C. Seeger, Peanuts Volume 1 by Schultz, Shortcomings, Not Even Out in Comic Stores Yet by Adrian Tomine, Bagel's Lucky Cat, Lucky Hat, Dave Cooper's new graphic novel, Exit Wounds by Ruto Motan, Spent by Joe Matt, Dogs and Waters by Anders Nilsson, Southern Cross by Lawrence Hyde, James Sturm's America, and King Cat Classics. I'm going to bring back our guest, the author of Laika, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Aren't you going to say my surname?
Dum dum da dum.
Avid Zaz.
Abadzis.
Yeah. I'm not all there today. I'm running on 25%. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. We were talking about Laika. One little thing I'm going to throw in here. The story of Koliev?
Koliev, yeah.
He reminds me of another Russian scientist a little bit. Leo Theremin.
Ah, the gentleman who created the musical instrument of the same name.
Mm-hmm. He was an incredibly brilliant inventor in New York, but he got kidnapped by the KGB and brought back to make spy technology.
Right. Yeah, I recall some of this. Fill me in a little more.
Just this interesting, like, characters that are these brilliant scientists in the Russian milieu, I guess. And he lived in pretty relative obscurity up until his death, which actually wasn't that long ago, if I'm right, if he is dead. He's pretty old. He was inventing closed-circuit televisions in the 20s. Smarty pants guy. So.
Yeah, he would be pretty old by now, I guess, wouldn't he?
So he's probably not around anymore. So let's get back into Laika. And Colin has a question.
Sure.
Well, when I was reading Laika, I was looking at the art and the style, and it reminded me a bit of what was going on in comics in the continent. People like Lewis Trondheim or Safar. Were you influenced at all by comics from Europe?
Yes. I think it's worth touching on the situation, I guess, that a lot of UK creators find themselves in a sense we're caught between two meccas. We've got American comics on the one side and European comics on the other, and no real comics industry of our own to speak of, although things are changing for the better now somewhat. And for myself anyway, I always looked in both directions. I was partially brought up in Switzerland, so I had relatively easy access to that sort of whole Franco-Belgian comics industry that informs most of Europe. But equally, you know, I had Peanuts and Marvel and DC and all the kind of the American stuff at my fingertips, because I actually went to an American high school. My oldest friend is from New York. You know, he had a huge pile of comics, so I was sort of working through both of these at the same time. But I'm digressing a little bit, but purposefully, I hope. these days, I mean, I I really loved the art in French comics, and I loved the fact that you could do all sorts of genres, and it wouldn't sort of matter what the art style was. It was always very effective, and it was always it sort of came from a different place from a lot of the much more sort of sturdily inked American stuff. I guess yes is the short answer to your question. Svarr especially is, I adore his work, Trondheim too, all of those guys who are sort of David B., part of that sort of modern movement of excellent French work. Mm-hmm. But I think Svarr especially has a sort of joie de vivre, a freedom to his work and his ideas that he expresses apparently very easily. I don't think it is easy. I just think it's so much a part of him. Mm-hmm. If you meet the guy, he's just kind of plugged into some sort of live, cartoonist wire. He's a pretty incredible person. I guess in terms of inspiration, I sort of looked at stuff like that and thought, well, you know what? I know I can do that. I know I can get there. It's just getting there. And equally, I think I was influenced by certain American cartoonists, people like Jessica Abel, who it turned out when I finally met her a few years ago, we became good friends, but she'd been influenced by my work in Deadline, sometime earlier. So it was a sort of nice circular...
Mm-hmm. Mutual respect.
Yeah, yeah. It all sounds a little bit cozy and back-scratching describing it, but it's nice to sort of... Because, to a certain degree, I did feel that in England you were sort of working in isolation. You're looking over the wall at these... you sort of feel like you come from the comics ghetto if you come from there, and you have to sort of work really, really hard to get noticed elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no way you can get this sort of... I actually went around several UK publishers with Leica, and a lot of them sort of looked at it a little bit sniffily and just didn't understand why I was... Well, don't you want to do it as text and illustration? No. The idea is it's a graphic novel, so... And they can... They're a little... we have a tradition, it's the land of Shakespeare. It's they're very good at kind of developing their literary imaginations and not so hot, perhaps, on the visual side mm-hmm. of things. Great with imagination, but it all goes into kind of TV and drama and those kind of theater and those kind of industries.
There are some fantastic English cartoonists, though.
There are many, but there's no uniform movement that unites them. There's some superb political cartoonists, and there are a great many sort of great alternative cartoonists and fantastic many mm-hmm. sort of writers. Alan Moore, for the mainstream, and Grant Morrison, Pete Milligan, Garth Ennis, to name but four right there. But there's a whole slew, there's a sort of generation from that kind of mid-90s point after Deadline and any other forum for alternative comics disappeared, who aren't really known outside the UK. They just sort of, they were left high and dry. And some of them kind of kept at it, which mm-hmm. includes me. But the... There's also as many who just kind of vanished. I don't know, perhaps they went into games, perhaps they went into animation or children's books or something.
Denny Eichhorn's favorite phrase to say is they're painting signs now.
Yeah. Oh, I hope not, but yeah, I guess it's possible.
Well, there's Beano. Ah.
Okay, so Leica.
Please.
Tell me about the research into Leica the dog.
The dog herself. There actually isn't an awful lot of information. Everything that's actually about her is basically recorded just a few days before they sent her up in Sputnik 2, because Korolev had such a short amount of time to build a satellite. He basically had a month. So the dog had to be selected from a pool of potential candidates, these Cosmo dogs, and she was she had two backups, one of whom wouldn't eat her food, so she fell out of the she was thrown out of the
Cosmodog program.
Yeah. So basically, she just—I mean, there was a whole pool of these dogs. There were like 25, 30 of them, all at the Russian Space Bureau, the Bureau for Aviation Medicine, as it was known at that time. But they basically, she was the most even-tempered dog, which is why she was selected. Not an awful lot beyond that is known about her. Everything that I kind of managed to get was anecdotal stuff, some of which I managed to get translated from Russian text by a very kind librarian at the British Library, who, once she understood what I was after, sort of combed through all these old Russian texts and sifted stuff and said, oh, you might be interested in this, and was good enough to translate it for me. The only thing that I kind of unearthed that isn't really in the book was that apparently she had this quite high, annoying bark. that was partially one of the reasons why she was selected. It's one of those things that you unearth this stuff, and it's some weird stories come into focus through the research process.
I could see why you would leave that out, though.
Yeah,
it would take away definitely from
the impact,
the appeal of the Laika character.
Well, that's one story. The other story is that actually she was just that sort of came about afterwards. That was one of those sort of what we would now call an urban legend that came about because she was renamed Barker from Kudryavka, which was her original name, and Laika means Barker in Russian, and so it's just, it's one of those stories that's derived from that. So anything that kind of like I wasn't absolutely sure about and I couldn't nail down, I just left out, basically. And the other aspect was I could kind of research the sort of generic training process for all of the dogs. That there's information about that, but you can, it is fairly easy to come by in a couple of very good textbooks. So that's where I could apply that to Laika. I knew she was going to go through the same training program as all the other dogs. So I applied that to her. And the rest is mostly anecdotal stuff about what happened to her and what she did shortly before the flight. And it's because it's sort of a work of historical fiction. There are some characters of my own in there. And I guess they sort of represent me and mine, and how I might react to that entire situation were I living under that regime.
Was Yelena an actual person?
Sorry, say that again.
Was Yelena?
Yelena. Yeah, she's there's a really good story about her that's kind of turned up as an epilogue, which is really bizarre because originally, she's a creation of my own.
And just so people know, that's the caretaker of
dog handler,
the dog handler for Lek.
Sorry. Yeah, they call her an animal technician or some sort of labyrinthine term like that.
The dog whisperer.
Yeah, the dog whisperer. She was a creation of my own, or so I thought, because I originally she was very, very loosely based on a woman who worked at that institution later, and who worked in a circus and was really, a Russian circus, was really good at training dogs and understood animals. But I knew that she hadn't come to that place until, I think, 1960 or 61, maybe even later than that. So I knew women work there. I knew women work there as dog handlers. But I was thinking, well, okay, I'll change the timing on this a little bit, just to kind of make it a little bit more even-handed. And because I wanted to have sort of a representative bunch of viewpoints as to the dog's eventual fate, and she would represent one of those. But after I finished the book, I had a conversation with this guy who wrote a book called Animals in Space. called Chris Dubbs, and I got a copy of his book, and we were just conversing about sort of little bits of detail and research that we'd each unearthed. And his earlier book, Space Dogs, had been really helpful in helping me research Laika too. So big ups to Chris, thanks for that. But in his book, there was a photograph of a woman who looks exactly like the character I drew. It's really spooky. You know, and she's standing there, you know, same build, same face, same hairdo, everything, kind of like with it, surrounded by a bunch of these Cosmo dogs. So I said to Chris, well, who is she? He said, I have no idea. He said, well, I've got this this photograph. You know, it's just one of the things that was sent to us around people, you know, from people around the world. She could be anyone. So I sent him a copy of my book. I don't know. I don't think he's read it yet. He hasn't got back to me. But I'm waiting to see what his response to that is. It's just weird. Very strange coincidence. So who knows? Truth is stranger than fiction and all of that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some kind of a synchronistical...
Yeah.
I'm sure Alan Moore would have something to say about that.
Yeah. It's there are these sort of coincidences and little magical occurrences. And they're... You just have to enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. Really. I interviewed Genesis Pure Origin a while ago, and we had several of those in the process of the interview of things happening around. It was quite odd, but we both acknowledged the oddness and went on. Now, we're nearing the end of our allotted time. What kind of future stuff do we have to look forward to? And you're doing a tour of North America right now, so where can people meet you?
I'm going to be doing a signing at Rocket Ship in Brooklyn.
Oh, I've heard many good things about that store.
Yeah.
Many, many good things.
Me too. I've never been there, so I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm doing that with Sarah Varon, and I think it's Sarah, yeah, this coming Sunday. And I will also be at SPX in Washington, D.C., which I don't think is in Bethesda anymore. I haven't been for the last couple
I went years. Last year, and it was in Bethesda.
Oh, right, okay, so maybe it's still there. But, yeah, the Small Press Expo, I'll be at that, and I'll be doing a sort of presentation and some signings and stuff to do with the making of Laika. So I'll have a small table there, so if you want to come along to that, come say hi.
Nice, and SPX looks like it's going to be quite a nice turnout. You've got yourself, Jeff Smith of Bone Fame, and Kim Deitch, and...
Yeah,
many
and
other talented
Ruti Modan, apparently.
Pardon?
Well. Pardon? Ruti Modan.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
I'm looking forward to meeting her because I really, really liked Exit Wounds.
She's actually, we're supposed to be interviewing her while she's in Canada or America. One of the two.
Right.
Like yourself, doing a tour of the western part of the
world. Well, yeah, I'm a fan.
It's a pretty gorgeous book. Thank you so much for coming and joining us today, Nick.
My pleasure.
People can check out Laika at many good comic book stores and bookstores, because for second books, you can even find the books in airports.
Great.
There we go. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Oh, I forgot to find out what he's doing next, but we're pretty much out of time. Reminder, people, give money, donate money. Here, I'll read our pitch cards. We have pitch cards and the podcast one, because we have podcasts for the Ink Stud Show, and if you listen... And like I think most people that do actually listen to the show other than Dad, Hi Dad, you know, listen to it through the podcast, all five of you. Thanks, guys. I'm just kidding. There's seven people that listen to the show that I know of. It's a joke. Laugh, Colin. Colin has no sense of humor at all. You know, podcasting isn't free, and we have a very complex server system to make sure that I push a button and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I have an hour of radio play that's saved and you can download from inkstuds.com or www.citr.ca. So a reminder, $25, $45, $60, $100, different amounts get you different stuff. $45 or more and you can get a fine selection of books, including Papai, Volume 1 by E.C. Seeger, Peanuts, Volume 1, Shortcomings by Adrian Tomei, Bagel's Lucky Hat, Dave Cooper's new book, which just came out in comic stores yesterday. Actually, Shortcomings isn't out in comic stores yet. And Adrian Tomei will be on the Ink Studs next month at some point when he's in town. It'll be myself and actually Mariel, who does the show previous to this, will be doing an interview with them. She's a big fan, and she's very excited. Joe Matt's Spent, Exit Wounds by Ruto Modan, that we were just talking about, the fantastic book, Dogs and Waters by Anders Nilsson, Southern Cross by Lawrence Hyde, James Sturm's America, America, yeah. I'm not going to sing the whole song. And King Cat Classics by John Porcellino. And I gotta say, actually, this time there's not a lot of people we've interviewed in the show. John's been on the show. Anders Nilsson's been on the phone on the show. And I think that's it from this list of people. But
no Seagar?
Yeah, he's kind of dead.
Oh.
Yeah, these comics are from the 30s or the 20s. And he'd already been doing Thimble Theater for many years before Popeye originally appeared. So it's kind of neat to see where Popeye originally came from. And it's gorgeous work. I had a weird guy talking
to me. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. Why aren't you people calling? Call now!
I'm sure they are calling. 822-1242. 822-8648. That's 604. 822-8648. Up next, Crimes and Treasons. I'm going to end off with a song. Leica's Theme by the Divine Comedy. Because, you know, we talked about Leica. And happy Sputnik Day.
Yay!
Oh, and next week is Rod Philbrandt.